Well, Pete Townsend, what you're on tour with The Who at the moment. What exactly is on stage when you go on? What exactly is The Who show now? It's not just the four of you playing anymore.
No, we spent, I suppose, about 14, 15 years of our career with just four guys in the band. Just guitar, bass, drums and singer. And probably pioneered that early heavy metal kind of lineup, which relies a lot on very, very, very high volume, loud, crashing sound to actually get any real sort of tone colour and excitement. And I think about 2 years before Keith Moon, our drummer, died, I started to get very disenchanted, not so much with the sound itself. I love it, you know what I mean, like AC/DC and all that stuff. I can take as much of it as anybody else can, but like as a player, I found it a little bit, I felt I was going around in circles a bit as a musician, and I've always wanted to expand the lineup of the band, but The Who have always had an incredibly strong sense of tradition. Our fans have always been, and this is probably our British fans as well, but I mean in particular the American fans that we played to in the early 60s, like the New York, Detroit, Chicago, San Francisco bunches. I mean, they've really got a strong sense of like The Who being The Who, and you don't tamper with it, you don't muck about with it.
How does this affect your repertoire? Because I personally, obviously, I only hear you about once every 2 years. You hear yourself whenever you play, naturally. But I'd be very disappointed, and I think most Who fans or ticket buyers would be, if you didn't do My Generation or the traditional Tommy bits. But you must get a bit fed up with See Me, Hear Me and all this sort of Touch Me business. I mean, how is the repertoire basically still the same on this tour, or are you getting rid of the old things?
No, we're not trying to get rid of any of the old stuff. I mean, obviously, when Keith died, the whole question of Who tradition went out the window in a way. In fact, both Roger and myself reacted in a really deeply emotional way to his death, not because we were grief-stricken. I mean, we miss the bastard, but I mean, you know, it's like we weren't sort of shedding that many tears, but I think we became deeply emotional when we suddenly realised that in a sense Keith's death had sort of released us from that being tied down to the old format. You know, I mean, we couldn't be The Who as we were anymore because, you know, one quarter of the cake was missing, and it was an opportunity for us to expand the band. We brought in Rabbit on keyboards. He'd worked with Crawler, who will probably be most well known to people through the Paul Rodgers and Paul Kossoff.
He's worked on a lot of records, of course, hasn't
yeah,
he?
Right. Yeah, right. And he's actually from Texas. He's an American keyboard player. He's lived in England for about 8 years. And he'd done a few sessions with us, and I brought him in because I felt he was the right temperament, and he's a brilliant musician. And we're also now working with brass players. We've got three brass players. And the reason for this, using brass players, for example, was because John Entwistle has often added brass parts to our stuff, particularly, for example, Quadrophenia. I think there's brass on practically every track. And he's got a really unique style of arranging because he does all the parts himself. He plays trumpet, trombone, flugelhorn, French horn, all that stuff. And on certain tracks that we played on stage, you just miss it so much, you know, when it's not there live. And so we now carry a brass section. And so what's actually happened is rather than our stage act not carrying as much old material, it tends to carry quite a lot more, but slightly different material. We actually got into an act for quite a long time, which was pretty much based on, I suppose, the stuff that we did in live at Leeds. You know, Summertime Blues, My Generation, a bit of Tommy, Can't Explain, Substitute, and that was it, really. That was the act. And a few other things thrown in, but now we play a lot of tracks from Quadrophenia, We play 5:15, which sounds great, Punk and the Godfather. We could play anything from Quadrophenia if we wanted to. We play I Can See for Miles, for example, which is a recent inclusion, because that was something that we always had difficulty playing live. So it's actually widened our repertoire in terms of the old stuff. We can look back at the old songs that we used to play and play a much wider variety of them.
So Who on Stage, the show that you're now taking around the world, is obviously different in that it's extended, but are you using in the act material, presumably? You must be, from the new album.
Yeah.
Can you just say something about the new album? I mean, the Who on Stage is different, but is the album the four guys, or are you using this bigger concept, the live concept, on the album?
We're not using brass players on the sessions. I don't know whether we'll actually overdub any brass. I don't really know. I mean, I think on the sessions that we've done so far, we've done guitar, bass, drums and piano. Rabbit's been included. And we've been working actually on a song also by Rabbit, sung by John Entwistle. As usual, the bulk of the material has been written by me, but, you know, that's another thing that I'd really like to see The Who continue to do, and that's to some extent, break that also quite self-conscious tradition that we've got of being obsessively tied down to doing Pete Townsend songs, because I think there's a lot of material that we could do by other writers. As it happens, this album is pretty much all within the band.
Do you mean other writers outside The Who?
Yeah.
Talking of other musicians inside The Who, obviously the traditional Who, John's doing some other recording, isn't he, outside The Who again? Can you tell us anything about that?
Yeah, I went to see him before we went in to start recording The Who album in February. I went to see him in L.A., and he was recording an album there, really very exciting project, with Joe Walsh on guitar and Joe Vitale, who used to be in Joe Walsh's band called Barnstorm and has now actually just joined the Eagles as an extra percussionist. And he's done tracks for a solo album, and with Joe obviously playing guitar on the tracks and doing a few solos and Vitale playing the drums. And really, really powerful, out-and-out heavy metal stuff, real airbanger stuff. It's great. And I heard, I suppose, about half of it when I was there, and it all sounds shit hot.
Yeah. Of course, Roger probably had the most commercial success of any individual member as split away from The Who for that period when his singles and albums, the Leo Sayer period, so we're doing well. Has he got any plans for making any records outside The Who?
I think Roger's solo career now has been focused towards his acting career.
You mean filmmaking?
Yeah, filmmaking. He developed and bought the script property, McVicar, and that film has just been completed. And he acts in that film, but obviously the music is an important part of the film. McVicar is a story about an English criminal who was a successful escaper, but was kind of caught up into that problem that I think a lot of criminals, even grandiose criminals and petty criminals, get caught up in, and then that's that once they've been inside, they tend to end up going back inside perpetually, just because of the fact that every time they go back to get sentenced, it's for whatever their latest crime is, it's viewed in as it were in context of their past offences,
cumulative kind of.
And he ended up with a life stretch. And the fascinating thing about the story, and I think the thing that really gripped Roger, and which fired Roger up to actually buy the property, and he desperately wanted to act the part of McVicar in the film, was the fact that Roger felt that he could have gone the same way. You know, if he hadn't have had a guitar when he was a kid and joined a band, that he might have ended up spending half of his life in the nick. And the album, and incidentally, by the way, Roger's acting in the film is absolutely amazing. I think it's clear that he really, really was consumed by the whole idea of it and very passionately involved in it, because his acting is completely unselfconscious and really powerful. Yeah, of course, and out of this has come an album.
Of course, John McVicar wasn't just known as an escapist, was he, in the sense that he was the number one hard man at the time as well. He was like, you know, if we had a most wanted, you know, public enemy number one during his freedom, he was seen in that light. I mean, does Roger, is it a sort of macho sort of role for Roger? It's not just a clever escapist, is it?
No, I think, in fact, John McVicar wasn't responsible for the cleverness of the final escape, the one that's seen in the film. It was Wally Probyn, who was a genius. He's actually played by Adam Faith. I think the secret of the McVicar film, and the reason why the music becomes important, and the reason why I think the album will be a success, because it is Roger singing most of the songs on the album, the soundtrack album will be successful, I think, again for Roger, as a solo album, just seen as music.
So it's not just soundtrack, atmosphere, music,
no.
It's his actual songs that could be issued, in, like singles, for instance.
Definitely,
Roger singing with... Who else is playing on it then? I mean, is there anybody else from The Who?
Kenny Jones plays drums, John plays bass, Rabbit on keyboards, and various other musicians, session musicians that joined in. Billy Nichols, as a friend of mine, wrote Leo Sayer's last hit in this country, Can't Stop Loving You, has written about four or five songs. I think Steve Gibbons has written a couple, and of course Russ Ballard, who has worked with Roger on solo albums before, has written some wonderful songs. I think the whole thing that fascinates me about the value of the music to the film is that what happened to McVicar to John McVicar was during the period that he was out, he escaped and he was free for about 2.5 years. During that period, he actually fell in love for the first time. He discovered what family life was about, and he was really, truly rehabilitated. And it was the irony of him being thrown back in for another 25 years, probably apparently until, you know, the day he died, that makes the music somehow the only way to properly tell the story, you know, because it's just too much of a fine line. And so the music's very important to the thing, and it's brought forth some really good stuff.
Yeah. Thinking in terms of your own solo projects, because obviously over the years probably you've been a man who could work away from The Who more than the others. Let's just knock something on the head first. Tommy, having seen it with the orchestra, having seen the film and so on, last year in London we saw a stage show which you partly backed, didn't you, to bring to the West End, and it ran for several months as a stage musical. Is that really the end of Tommy? I mean, frankly, apart from putting Tommy on ice, I mean, you're not going to do much more with him.
I don't think it's the end at all. I think it's extremely likely that more will happen. I mean, I've absolutely no control over the beast. I've heard a lot of talk about an American touring show, and the New York theatre backers are on the phone once a week. So it's really just a decision as to at what point one allows something else to happen. I mean, the problem that I've always had is that, for example, with the show that happened in the West End, I didn't do that, I didn't get involved in that personally because I was that interested in Tommy anymore. But, you know, I was fascinated with the idea of being involved in a West End musical. And I had a great time, you know, I got into the whole sort of theatre scene for 2 months and really enjoyed it. I learnt a lot of lessons. The show would have run forever, except that it was costing money. You know, we had an enormous chorus and a big band and lasers and God knows what. And although it was, you know, it had good attendances, if it had filled up every day for the next 100 years, we still would have made a loss. So I started to learn a lot about, you know, lowering your sights. You don't go into a West End production as though you're doing a Who show. You know what I mean? It's like the slightly different mechanics. And but I don't think Tommy's, as I said, I don't think it's really in my control. It's a piece of public property, and if somebody wants to do it or use it or whatever, I think it's probably a lot left in it.
Obviously, you've got this new album. Empty Glass, is that the title of the album?
Yep.
I heard the album through. You sound very confident on it. The start of the album sounds very confident and very finished. I mean, do you think in your own work that you've now got to a stage where you really... You can go and you say, that's exactly what I want to do. It sounds a very polished album. It doesn't sound as if you want to add anything or take it away. It's as if there's any uncertainty. It's as if you've gone in and said at the end of several months, OK, that's the album.
No, I don't think I'm that way at all. I think, you know, I've got a lot of confidence about recording and writing because I've been doing it for a long time. And, you know, like I said, I've got a studio at home, or have had for a long, long time. And so I live in a studio. I'm familiar with all the ins and outs of that side of it. But I think really what gives the album its complete confident feel is the fact that I was lucky enough to find absolutely the right producer to work with. And it was a real sort of, almost like a chance.
Who was that?
And it was Chris Thomas produced the album. Chris Thomas is probably currently most famous for the fact that he produced the Pretenders stuff, which he was working on at the same time he was doing the solo album with me, so I'm knocked out that they're successful. And I really like that, all their records too. But I met him when I recorded with Paul McCartney on the Rockestra track, which is that thing where Paul McCartney got about 20 musicians, like four drummers, four guitar players and stuff, and put an instrumental together on the Back to the Egg album. And I saw Chris like running around, and I said, what are you doing here? And he said, I'm producing Paul McCartney. And I was absolutely amazed, because the first time I met Chris Thomas, who came from the same town as me, Ealing in West London, I was producing him in a group called The Cat, and this was in 1966. And Speedy Keen, who was Thunderclap Newman, wrote Something in the Air and all that stuff, was the drummer in the group. And I went back through Chris's material. I listened to the Kokomo album, to the Procol Harum stuff that he'd done. I realised that he'd worked with the Sex Pistols, and I just thought, this has got to be the guy, you know. And I rang him up, thinking that obviously he'd be the busiest man in the world, and he was really keen to do it. And I think it was 100% right for me, because I felt comfortable with him. We brought up in the same neighbourhood. We shared a lot of friends. And I just felt really easy, and he was able to pull out of me, I think, particularly on vocal performances, a lot more sort of natural performance than I could get with anybody else. Because for a long time I was thinking about using various American producers, maybe Bill Simzik, who I really like, and I like his work, or Phil Ramone, who did Billy Joel and Paul Simon. Or, you know, maybe Tom Dowd or Jerry Wexler, you know, all those great, great producers. But the problem is that they're Americans, and either I'd have to go over to America or they'd have to come over here, and there's a cultural difference. And I felt that my solo album should be first be me, and should be English and recorded here.
It's a very sort of lyrical sort of album. You know, it's not a heavy rock driving sort of album. There are tracks like that, Who style tracks, but to me having just heard the album through, it sounded almost like an extension of Quadrophenia, in the sense that there's that you could imagine any of the songs fitting into that Quadrophenia album, but without the obstacle of the Who being in there and you having to think about the Who. It's almost as if you have felt for this album, I can do what I like, I'm free from the Who, and I can follow my own personal lyrical nature away from what the Who stand for.
I think you're right, obviously, but I think probably an interesting jump off from that is that when I came to write the songs for the Who album, the current album that we're working on, I decided, right, I'm going to operate in exactly the same way. You know, I'm not going to write songs self-consciously for The Who. I'm going to write songs and just shoot from the hip, as it were. You know, it's not to glamorise it, but not in, in a sense, not to sort of get in the way. And in fact, a lot of the material that The Who is working on at the moment are songs which could very, very easily suit me on my own, or hopefully anybody. I think the thing about The Who right now is that we're flexible, we're open. I think a good song is a good song. I think a good song can be sung by anybody. I know that certain things on the solo, like on my solo album, for example, I think stuff like Empty Glass, there's a lot about it which is very personal, but there's a lot about it which is very universal. I just think at the moment I'm writing very spiky lyrics. And I think the stuff that I've submitted for the for this current Who album, I think there's a couple in there which are, which 2-3 years ago I think Roger would have just said, listen Pete, I can't do that, you know, it's just too much about you and what you're going through. And this time he's just said, right man, and stuck in and really got into him. And I think the difference is that he, like the rest of us in the band, have not, we haven't got an idea of ourselves as being like a particular fixed kind of band anymore. We don't think of ourselves anymore as The Who. We just think of ourselves as like performers and musicians, and so we feel we can almost adapt ourselves to anything.
Yeah, well, we've talked about John and Roger and your own projects. Obviously, we've got to mention Kenny Jones, the new fourth member of The Who, and you've also said that now The Who feel they could do various things, they're free to break away. Frankly, do you feel that the death of Keith meant artistically for The Who a break with the old traditions, and was it almost a releasing element for The Who as an artistic unit?
I think it's absolutely no question about it. I think what a lot of people probably forget was is that although Keith appeared to be like a kind of a, you know, demonic fatalist in some senses, he was a very, very, very powerful and influencing character, and was very, very resistant to musical change. I mean, he had his own particular way of playing, and that's what he stuck to. And nobody who's ever written anything or worked in anything creative will ever tell you anything different. The more severe the limitations are, the more interesting it is to write for or create for. So for me, The Who was never
like the Blues.
It never felt restricting. It was always very, very exciting to come up with something which was right for The Who, but also said something that I wanted to say as a writer, that Roger could sing, that John could play bass on, which was a great track live, etc. So it wasn't as though Keith was holding us back or holding us down. That's not the point. The thing was is that The Who as a band, and the fans of The Who and the history of The Who were weighing us down. I mean, the fact that, for example, you know, Tommy dragged around in a saddlebag, and it's like, well, you go onto the stage and you've got 15 years of music, and thank God The Who didn't make as many records as, say, The Stones or The Beatles, otherwise we would have, you know, had an endless amounts of material which people insisted on hearing, and if you leave one of them out, you get a lot of nasty letters. Why don't you play this one? Or why don't you do as much John Entwistle stuff as you should do? Or whatever, you know, I mean, this kind of thing. And that's how it released us. It cracked, you know, it just sort of cracked the whole. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a musical freedom that we necessarily gained, because in some ways that, like I said, limitations are great, you know. I think if anyone of the band had died, you know, but whatever kind of misadventure led to it, I think it would have led to exactly the same result. I think the band reacted to Keith's death, which at first was shattering, and I think probably each of us thought, right, well, that's it. That's obviously the end of The Who, because The Who can never exist. But we suddenly realised, Well, of course, it is the end of The Who as it was. It's the end of the old four-way magic. But it's also a great opportunity for us. And rather than waste Keith's death, we thought we'd...
Rather than let it pull you down, yeah, use it we as thought a we'd, spur to go on to something
take
else.
It, and I think it was Roger that first sort of woke up. We were at a meeting out at Shepperton, and we were talking about various things like the financial problems that came about, dealing with Keith's estate and all this kind of thing, and how we were going to work all that out, all the boring bloody problems that you go through when somebody dies. And he said, listen, you know, I think that... And it sounded, you know, it sounded like slightly the kind of thing that, you know, you people say when somebody dies. But somebody has to say it. It's corny and it's, you know... But, you know, he said, you know, I think we should carry on for him, in a sense.
He would have wanted it.
Exactly.
And of course, in some ways, because Keith was underrated in the sense that his public gossip column style of living rather overlaid the fact that you don't really hear Ringo-style drummers, you don't really hear a lot of Charlie Watts-style drummers, but right the way through the history of rock since the 60s, right through to the punk drummers and Rat Scabers and everybody else, they're moony in a sense, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, his style is the style of rock drumming.
I think it's exclusively... You see, people like Ringo and Charlie Watts are American-style drummers. And Keith never listened to blues.
Yeah.
Never listened to much black music. Didn't like it. And I think, you know, people like... I mean, Charlie Watts is a jazz man. You know, he sits and listens to Charlie Parker all day. And Ringo, as far as I'm concerned, plays like a black drummer, you know. That straight sort of out-and-out thing. I think what's interesting at the moment with Kenny in the group is to watch how Kenny's style, which is very much a sort of early English style, is actually changing too. Not growing towards anything like Keith's kind of fluidity, because Keith was a you know, like almost like making constant patterns all the time, like running water, you know. It was never
very
like,
romantic sort of a drummer, yeah, in a sense, wasn't it?
And also quite expressive and
that's what I mean. He wasn't just a timekeeper, he was a romantic, yeah, a flowery sort of a drummer in a sense.
And but what's happening with Kenny is that John and Kenny and I are starting to actually, for the first time, probably build up some of that intuition that we've been so used to over the years through working together with Keith and John and I.
Well, it must make a great social change, because obviously, compared with Keith, I mean, Charles Manson would seem like the quiet one in the group. but Kenny is relatively introverted, keeps himself to himself in the same sense that John Entwistle does.
He has his
and
moments.
So the two of them could travel to Edinburgh without speaking, you know. At least I get that impression. But I mean, it must have made a change when you meet together and work together. Because Kenny must be, A, more reliable, and B, just
well,
super quiet.
Well, I get to crack more jokes, basically.
There was always this feeling with her, of course, that it split into camps a bit. I mean, there was probably, Keith and John, and I suppose you and Roger. I mean, that was the only way it could do. People always used to think this. Do you find now that you work more as a team, as a foursome, when you do meet and work together?
Yeah, I think so. I think the basic personalities of the guy and the guys in the band haven't changed. I think Roger's still resistant, slow to get used to change. Can be very, very unconfident about things until the public have actually accepted them. You know, he can do a track and really, like a vocal performance on a track, and really be knocked out with it. Take a tape cassette home and somebody from the pub can come down and say, "Yeah, I don't like that." And that's it, it's off the album. You know, it's like, he's still fragile in that sense. John is still reasonably quiet, you know, but I mean, that's a joke for a start. He's actually an arch lunar. And I don't think I've changed very much. I mean, I miss being Moon's straight man. But now, you know, I don't know. I think if we are closer together, it's because of something that happened even before Keith died. I think we were growing closer together. We were growing up. We are growing up.
Well,
we'd started to like care less about one another's faults and start to get more into one another's better points. And I mean, it's the one thing that is sad, not that anybody should ever brood over it, but I think the one thing that is a bit sad about Keith's death is that he was starting to actually stabilise, or appeared to be. And Roger always says that that's probably one of the reasons that he died, is that he could never have stood being normal.
Yeah, he's matured himself to
death. Yeah, matured.
Like a good brandy. But I'm surprised to hear you say that you're drawing more together. I remember John and Keith coming in for the BBC to introduce, I think it's probably the Who By Numbers album, and we got an early tape of the album and the track listing, and they didn't know which titles were which tracks. And they said, oh, well, what's Pete done here? And they had to sit and listen to it and identify them as if they came in and did things and then left you to pull it together. I mean, were you at that stage, we're talking to probably 75, 76 now.
75, that was,
yeah. So were you, by that time, obviously saying, look, I'm the organiser, I'm the group leader, whatever people say. I mean, obviously people see you as the Who, but you had to take on that role. Did you take it on then, and has it changed now since Keith's death?
No, what happened at that particular time was just that I think Who By Numbers is the album that I think that has like grown the most gracefully, because it was probably the first time that I ever did what I said that I was doing, for example, on the current album, which is just shoot from the hip, just write. And I took in, I think, 9 songs, and there are 8 songs on the album, or maybe 10 songs, 9 songs on the album. I said, that's it. That's all I can do. I can't do any more. You know, I'm not going to... And because at that particular time, I'd been through the whole Tommy film with Ken Russell. We'd done a very, very heavy touring schedule. I was really worried about booze. I was unhappy because Roger was really unhappy about the managers that we had at the time, Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp, and wanted to get them out, and that caused me a hell of a lot of pain because they weren't managers to me, they were friends. And although I knew that Roger was right and that we were past the point where they were really managing us and we did need management, it was painful for me to know that they were going to go. And I felt the group was just getting very sort of messy and dissipated, and if you like, these camps that you were talking about were at their most acute around that period. And so I just went in with a lot of songs which were really about the way I felt, and I think I forced the band into a corner with that material, you know, songs like However Much I Booze and How Many Friends Have I Really Got and all that stuff, you know. I mean, when I first played the demos, Keith cried. He actually burst into tears, you know. And I mean, I don't know quite what brought it on, whether he was identifying with the stuff or whatever, but he actually burst into tears and he came and put his arms around me. I suppose he was thinking, poor Pete, or something. But that was the kind of material that I was dishing up. And
I think
the group recoiled from the stuff. They recoiled from it. And I had to become somewhat a figure of fun for a bit. But after that recording, I went away and I got me head together. And we got into a tour and it was all right. I mean, I needed to go through that kind of cathartic...
But did you think in the year or so before Keith's death that the group might break up, that might be about the time to finish the... give it the album?
After 75, from 75, 76, 77, 78, up until Keith's death, I wanted to get out of the band. And the band knew that, and I think a lot of our fans knew that. and I know our management knew that. But the reasons were not really very well founded. It was just like, in a sense, it was just based on the fact that I wanted to, I suppose, change my life in a way. You know, I didn't like things the way it was. I didn't like life the way it was.
Also, of course, that period did coincide with a change in the British rock scene. From 76 onwards, there was that feeling that the old school that played itself out were running around in ever-decreasing circles, and suddenly the Sex Pistols and the punk thing came up, and everything was changed. Nothing was the same after that. But ironically, you, The Who, and you personally, were probably the only clear survivors from the old scene who were definitely heroes to the new kids who were coming up.
Well, I think maybe the reason that we'd survived as heroes was because the fact that, you know, we were never afraid and are never afraid of self-examination or of self-recrimination. I don't think there's anything wrong with, when you're on an up, saying, right, I'm on an up, you know. When you think you're King Dick, say you're King Dick. But, you know, if you're on a downer, then the only way to get out is with other people's help. And the only way that you can actually get other people's help is to express that you've got a problem.
The thing was that you were obviously a hero to the punk generation, but then to the relatively short-lived succeeding mod generation, who very literally identified with the mid-60s and the era of Quadrophenia. You obviously were then a hero to their generation. Did you see any of the mod bands? Because they'd always include a Who number to great applause from these 15, 16-year-olds.
Yeah, I saw a few punk bands, and I've seen a few of the mod groups. I think that it's a mistake. It would be a mistake for me to acknowledge this hero thing. I mean, I can tell you a story which illustrates my angle on it. When The Who were rehearsing at the Rainbow Theatre for the first shows that we did with Kenny Jones, we were going to go over to Cannes Film Festival and, you know, like, unveil the Quadrophenia film and do some shows over there. And we were pretty nervous because it was the first shows we'd done for 2 years and first shows with Kenny and the band and Rabbit. And we decided that as we were there at the Rainbow rehearsing, we might as well do a concert, an off-the-cuff concert. So when the tickets went on sale, of course, the first thing that happened is that there's about 44 Parkers lined up, you know, all the Who on their thing, and targets on their back and O's with arrows and all that. So I roll up and I just couldn't resist. And these kids are like 14, no older than that, 14, 15. In fact, you know, under normal sort of like licensing laws, shouldn't actually even be allowed in the Rainbow. I can't resist going up to Geezer at the end of the line and saying, you know, what do you actually expect to happen? You know, what do you expect to hear us play? And he said, who are you? That's exactly what he said to me.
Good title for an album.
That's the whole thing. I think that a lot of the mods were wearing like, And still today you see a few stragglers around with like little things with The Who on. It's a symbol. It's like the way the Hell's Angels used to wear swastikas and 69 Club things. It meant nothing. It's just a thing that if you were Hell's Angels, you had to have that somewhere on your leather. And with mods, it's you've got to have one of those little gold stickers with an O over the U arrow. And half of them don't even give a shit for The Who. I mean, they're just not interested. It's just like a piece of the stuff that you have to have. And I think there's a big difference between that kind of heroism, if you like, which is, I think, irritates a lot of the mod bands that I've spoken to, you know, get very, very irate about The Who associating themselves in any way with the new mod movement. They insist that it's a new thing, and they feel that The Who machine is exploiting through the Quadrophenia film.
You're
something
cashing in on them.
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose to some extent they've got a point. But I mean, there's a difference between that and the kind of heroism that exists with somebody like Rat Scabies or you know, Steve and Paul of the Sex Pistols or whatever. I mean, people like that I can really relate to because I know that it's affection, not heroism. It's like, you know, they genuinely care about what we've done. They've lived with it. They've been brought up with it. And I feel when I'm in the company of people like that, I feel I'm in the company of fellow musicians and friends rather than somebody that sort of says, oh, you know, he's God himself. Because it's only when people don't know you that they do that.
People have seen you, as we've said, succeeding generations of young rockers have seen you as a hero. Apart from admiring fellow professionals and talking about people as friends, do you still have any heroes, or is it all really, is the guilt fallen off the rock gingerbread in that sense?
I think what's happened to me is that I've gone past the point of actually wanting heroes, in a way. For years, I think since 1967, I've followed an Indian master called Maya Barber. And if you like, he's been my hero. And he's been the only single hero that I need. You know, I mean, to me, he's, you know, like the boss. And stands above everybody in all fields and all professions and all. And I think there's a tremendous shallowness to people in the entertainment industry. I mean, it's the very fact that somebody feels the need to be a hero that makes them get up on the stage to start with, and that is something which, for some reason, the human race seems to applaud, and yet it's a weakness. It's a weakness to want to be a hero. It's a weakness to want to be, you know, to go on a stage and be applauded for jumping up and down or whatever. And a weakness which actually, you know, makes some of us a very good living. I don't know why. if anybody's going to be a hero to me, I mean, it's going to be like Jesus Christ downwards, you know. I mean, I'm not going to go too far down. You know, I don't...
Perhaps
for years and years, you know, the kind of heroes that I had, like people like Jimmy Reed, Chuck Berry, Mick Jagger, Keith Richard, people like this, I've met them all, I've seen them, you know, and it's like they're just people. And I think that's the thing is that when if you manage to hang on in this business long enough, you get finally to meet everybody. You know, Margaret Thatcher, Jimmy Carter. Who else can you meet? Like people that run the world. Yeah. And when you find out that they're just people too, and I don't know, it deflates the whole... You suddenly realise, in a sense, what I'm trying to get to, is that it makes you feel very strange about the way that others view you. In other words, you suddenly wake up and you think, God, you know, people might have as much of a wrong angle on what I'm really like as I did about, say, Muhammad Ali or something.
So you think...
Who, when you meet, is an absolute sweetheart until you run the camera. You know, and then he sort of does all his stuff. But apart from that, I mean, you could go out to dinner with him and have a really quiet evening. You know, I mean, it'd have difficulty getting him to talk.
So you think, in a sense, what you're saying is that heroes, or the need for heroes, let's say, hero worship, is part of immaturity. It's part of the young process.
Yeah, I think so.
How old are you now?
I'm 35 next birthday, which is May. 34 now. Temporarily.
34 and a half.
And in 5 years, I'll be 40. And then after that, I'll be 45. And then I'll be 60. Well, maybe I'll be 60. Where's Wood?
Do you expect to go on, then, as an approaching middle-aged rock and roller, as far as you can see?
There's only one way to say this. I mean, it might be the kind of statement which won't appeal to every kind of radio system that there is, but I mean, I found that the only way to get through, like, the next month is to not give a shit about stuff like that. Not to not care, exactly. I mean, I still care very much about myself and the people around me, and I care about the quality of the stuff that I put in and the honesty of it. You know, I want to be honest. But I've spent so much of my life worrying about all this stuff, you know, about getting older and thinking about, you know, I mean, even Rough Boys, the track on my solo album, was coming out as a single, was a thing which a song which was inspired when I went back to my neighbourhood and I saw these different kids in leather gear, and I thought, well, what? How would I feel if I was 16 in Ealing now, you know, Acton now, Shepherd's Bush now? How would I feel? You know, what would I be like? And you know, would the kind of expression that you can get out on the street today, for example, prevented me from picking up a guitar, let's say? I don't know. It's like, you know, what you can get away with. And I've done so much of that that now I just don't really worry about it anymore. In fact, it was a couple of the guys in the Sex Pistols that told me to stop worrying. You know, they said, what are you bloody worried about? You know, worried about going up, growing old. All right, you're growing old. Who cares? You know. And I suddenly realised that whole sort of punk attitude, which at first appeared to be so sort of like hinged on sort of anarchy pointed at the establishment, was actually true anarchy. In other words, you know, just live and just enjoy yourself and don't get in your own bloody way. And I actually managed to pick that up, and I think it was a great help to me at the time. So I think I really gained a tremendous amount from the musical explosion that happened here a couple of years ago, and continues to happen, thank God.
Well, Pete Townsend, thank you for talking to us. You have your current solo album, Empty Glass, available, but let's finish then on the track that you've just been speaking about, Rough Boys.